Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. The new year is being marked by extreme weather conditions across the country. Heavy rains that caused massive flooding in Northern California are now moving south, which forecasters say could lead to mudslides near Los Angeles. In the Southwest, it's a lack of rain that has sparked devastating wildfires. The worst drought in 50 years proved to be a tinderbox in Texas, with fires scorching about 30,000 acres and claiming at least four lives. Dozens of wildfires have also started in Oklahoma and New Mexico, where scores of people have been evacuated and dozens of homes have been damaged. Joining us on the line is Tracy Weaver with the Texas Forest Service. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Deborah.
Now, you're near Ringgold, Texas, which has been right near where these fires have broken out in Texas. Can you describe what it's like there?
Well, the town of Ringgold is a small community of about 100 people, and it was virtually devastated by this fire. About 32 homes were destroyed in this community alone. It was just a very devastating day. We worked 18 large fires in Texas yesterday, and we're just extremely busy.
So, and it's basically affecting a huge area of the state.
It really is, from the Panhandle all the way to north of Dallas and south to almost to San Antonio. So the drought conditions have just left, like you said, left Texas as a tinderbox, and we just haven't seen conditions like this before. We've not had a devastating fire day like we did yesterday. It's unprecedented here.
I'm wondering, can you tell me about the effort to control the fire? Who's doing it? What about when you talk about working these long hours throughout the day? What about the firefighters? Where are they coming from, and what are they doing to make sure that they have enough rest to be able to do this effectively?
Well, most of the fire departments in Texas are all volunteers, and so it's amazing that these guys are able to respond like they did. Just on the Ringgold fire alone up here in Monte County, we had 50 fire departments responding from as far away as Tarrant County, which is the Fort Worth area. Just an amazing response, but that was a Sunday, you know, and a holiday when a lot of people are off work. That may not be the case today or tomorrow when we're supposed to have high fire danger, because these guys do have a regular job. Texas Forest Service has also brought in a lot of assets from 22 different states to help out with these fires, and we're utilizing helicopters as well as some national resources such as heavy air tankers, just trying to get a handle on these fires.
What do you think sparked these unprecedented fires?
Well, some of the fires, two of the fires that we know the causes on were both sparked by power lines, because of we had 50-mile-an-hour wind gusts yesterday and relative humidity dropping down to 5%, which is like what you would see in the desert, certainly not in Texas. So that's what we know of on two of them. The rest of the fires, I'm not sure in the cause of them. Fortunately, it didn't appear like we had a lot of New Year's Eve revelers out shooting fireworks off late in the night and through yesterday starting fires. People are tending to heed the warnings that it's extremely dry and they're being very careful out there, but there's not much you can do about wind slamming power lines together or pushing trees in power lines.
So it's just that the conditions were just ripe for something like this.
Oh, we had every factor come together that it takes to have the kind of conflagrations we had yesterday. We had the high wind, extremely dry vegetation, very low relative humidity and warm temperatures. It was 83 degrees yesterday here, which is way above normal. So you add all those components together, all you need is a spark, and you're going to get a large fire. And the rates of spread were absolutely incredible, particularly on the carbon fire down in Eastland County. Every time we'd asked the acreage on it, it had more than doubled. Just astounding.
Are you talking with any people who've been affected by this, Tracy? What are they saying?
I haven't had much time to talk to many people evacuated, but, you know, the firefighters out there that I've talked to are just shocked by how fast the fire spread, by how high the flame links are, and the fact that they really couldn't do a direct frontal assault on these fires because it's just too dangerous. So for them to just try to hold back and protect life and property was all they could do, and, you know, that's hard on them. They want to get the fire put out, and they want to be done with it, and it was just a monster.
Is there any indication, does anybody know at this point, when these fires might be under control?
On all the large fires we're working, we're feeling pretty comfortable with our containment lines around them, but we still got to get a lot of the hot spots put out and make sure that we don't have any embers that'll spot outside of our fire breaks and cause our fires to take a run again, especially toward the communities that are still under a little bit of threat, like Nakona.
Tracy Weaver is with the Texas Forest Service. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you.
One of the most debilitating and confusing mental illnesses is schizophrenia. Its symptoms are described as severe delusions, hallucinations, disorganized thought and speech, and deteriorating work performance, social skills, and appearance. What makes it confusing is schizophrenia affects people differently, and only about half of those afflicted ever reach a point where they're considered in recovery. Most require treatment for their entire lives. 52-year-old Carolyn Spiro and her twin sister Pamela Spiro Wagner know the devastating toll of schizophrenia firsthand. Their identical twin sisters, Carolyn, also known as Linny, is a psychiatrist, and Pamela, or Pammy, is a gifted writer who is also one of more than 3 million Americans diagnosed with schizophrenia. The sisters have chronicled their stories in the book Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. Here and Now's Robin Young spoke with them this fall.
So our listeners know, you each take turns in the book telling the story from your unique vantage point. Identical twins, but completely different views of things. And Pam, I wonder if we can start with you. If I'm reading the book right, it sounds as if the voices that you heard, the whispering people, you call them, first show up in the book when you're about 11 or so. Is that about when you started hearing them?
Yes. About when, well, exactly when Kennedy, JFK, was killed. Which wasn't the cause of the people. Mostly it was the trigger, the shocking event that brought them into being. But any shocking event could have happened.
We understand that about schizophrenia, that sometimes it's a genetic component, but it takes a shock to the system to sort of unleash
right,
it.
Right.
Well, Pammy, what did the voices say to you?
At first they were saying my name in various forms. And then they were saying nonsense words, which I tried to counter with thinking nonsense words or thinking the multiplication tables backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. And then in a very strange way, they'd imply that I killed Kennedy. All of this was in nonsense syllables, in like, you know who know, kill her, kill him, kill him, mm-hmm. Kill her, kill him. Mm-hmm. And yet I came to understand through all of this that I had killed Kennedy.
Did you tell anyone?
No, I couldn't tell anyone. I'm not sure why.
Who would have believed you, Pam? I mean, why would you tell anyone you were hearing voices and that you killed Kennedy when no one in their right mind would have, you know, taken you seriously?
That's Pam's sister, Carolyn. And, you know, Carolyn, I'm wondering, you know, in that same area of the book, you describe your sister Pam, as you saw her, as perfect, you know, perfect in every way. A little jealous of her, you know, a little bit.
Oh, yeah, she was. She seemed to me anyway.
But did you have any sense that anything was wrong?
At that time, absolutely not. I basically thought she was playing up to the adults for attention. If she'd suggested that she'd killed Kennedy, I would have, you know, rolled on the floor thinking this was hilarious.
Well, you both excelled at school. You went on to Brown University. Pammy, still living in her private hell until it began to leak out. She couldn't hide it anymore. Linny, as Pammy got older, what did you see?
Well, you know, in the beginning of the more obvious stages, she didn't dress very well. She was disheveled, didn't communicate very much with most of the family, was quite paranoid a lot of the time. Many of the family members didn't know how to communicate with her. I think it probably was easier on both parts often to just keep their distance.
She's chain smoking. She's living in squalor.
Yes, that's true. People were disappointed. She probably felt, I don't know, Pammy, did you feel that you were letting people down?
Your description of me in the book appalled me. I had no idea
how bad you
that
looked.
You saw me as a bag lady, essentially, that you didn't recognize me in the hospital. I had no idea I smelled or that I was so disheveled.
And Pam, I'm wondering, too, you speak about five people who monitor your movements. You write about how people on television are monitoring you. There's the crinkly gray paper.
It's gray, crinkled paper, and it has to be spoken like that. It's not gray, it's not crinkled, and it's not paper. It's gray, crinkled paper, and it's the secret to the universe. It's the secret to world peace. It's the secret to the universe. and it's the message that I have to translate for the world. Lenny, what is it?
I mean, the truth is it's a delusion. It's Pammy's brain misfiring in I'll oversimplify it, but it's a misfiring circuit in her brain that gives her this sense of certainty and knowledge about something that is not true.
Pammy, do you remember what you might have felt like before all the hard work you've done, the hospitalizations? Do you remember what you might have thought if someone told you there is no such thing? That doesn't make sense, gray crinkle paper.
Oh, absolutely. I can get back into gray crinkled paper in a heartbeat. It's only when Lenny reminds me step by step, word by word, what she means by delusion, and reminds me how it's a delusion and why, that I remember, oh, gray crinkled paper isn't real. It isn't real. It's just a delusion. That I can remember that and not get caught up in it.
But you just said something important. So you can go back into that place.
Basically, when you asked me about gray crinkled paper, I was back talking about gray crinkled paper with all the belief in it that there ever was.
Actually, Robin, I would say it's more remarkable that she can stop at all now and say, oh, yes, now wait a minute. This is that thing that Lenny says is actually not real. There are a lot of ups and downs. Every time you think things are going to be stable for a while, she would stop medication, and I understood why, because the side effects were so bad. She'd stop the medication and end up back in the hospital in terrible, terrible shape. But in the last 6 months, on a new combination of medications, she has become a new person. She has just blossomed. It's unbelievable how good she's become. So that it's true. I start to have hope that maybe we're actually seeing, if not a cure, perhaps a long-term possibly a permanent remission. It's unbelievable to me.
Pammy, do you feel that you're in a remission?
Oh, I'm absolutely in a remission. I mean, I went to a hotel. I went to a restaurant. I just got wanded today at a metal detector, which I've been terrified might happen if I went through a metal detector, which I've avoided completely by never going anywhere. I've never been to a hotel. A restaurant? Are you kidding?
Yeah, we've got a whole new book to write about how we've gotten her to do all these new things.
That's Carolyn Spiro, who is co-author with her sister Pamela Spiro Wagner of the book Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. Our conversation with them continues after a short break. There is more coming up here and now. Continuing our conversation with Pamela Spiro Wagner and Carolyn or Lenny Spiro about their fiercely honest memoir, Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. Pamela Spiro suffers from schizophrenia, and Robin Young asked her about how new drug treatments are helping quiet the imaginary voices that have tormented her most of her life.
Well, I'll tell you, I take two antipsychotics, one of the new ones, one of the old ones. I take three anticonvulsants, and I take a whole host of other ones for various reasons. But and that basically leaves me like a bowl of raw wood, basically put together, but not anything more than a bowl of splinters. And then I started taking a drug for narcolepsy, which if you've read the book, you know I also have. But this drug has basically polished off the bowl so that I'm now, you can eat off me, you can wash me, you can do anything you want to me.
And maybe change the metaphor.
Well, you can change the metaphor any way you want. But basically all the rough edges have been polished. so that I'm as good a ball as you are. And I think this drug has been knitting together everything that was just raw before.
It sounds, I mean, just a terrific place right now. But Carolyn, I want to also just ask you how hard it was along the way. Pammy alluded to the fact that she tried to overdose. At another point, voices are telling her to take Drano. Lenny, you're on the phone with some health workers trying to find Pammy, trying to stop her. And there's a point where it seems as if, Pammy, you're exhausted from trying to live with this disease, in part for your sister. And Lenny, you're exhausted with trying to keep your sister from dying.
Alive.
Yeah, alive.
Well, it was hard. There were definitely times that I wondered if I had any right to keep insisting that she go on. She would be desperate to want to end her life, want to stop going into the hospital, want me to just stop calling, leave her alone, stop insisting that she take her medication, and want me to give up on her. And I just simply refused to give up. I just said to myself, essentially, either she'll ignore me and she won't be around someday and I won't be able to do anything about it, or someday she'll thank me for not giving up.
Oh, yes, I will, because you got me to this place.
But at that one point, Lenny, I mean, you would say to Pammy, you can't kill yourself because you'll murder me too.
Right. And I have said that to her on any number of occasions. That
Unfair.
I've said that I will pull out all the stops, that you simply cannot do that to me.
And Pammy, can you explain how hard it is? You know, at one point, you on the phone say to Lenny, I know you want me to live, but, you know, I can't. I can't hold on. Why?
Yeah.
It was so hard?
I had basically lost all hope that anything would change. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I had no pleasure in anything. I had no hope for the future. I had nothing in the present. And my sense of the past was that the past was nothing but wasted. So I had no future, no present, or no past. And all I could see was that it was going to continue just as it had.
So what did I tell you? Told you to borrow mine.
Hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one thing a twin can give you.
Yeah. And people all through my life have given me hope when I've lost hope. Somebody or other has maintained hope for me when I've lost hope. So I'm lucky in that sense.
Pamela, you also had something that was uniquely yours. You can write. And in 1993, you got one of your first prizes for an article you wrote about health insurance coverage for the mentally ill. At the awards presentation, you read a poem.
It's called To Forgive Is... And essentially, it's to forgive is to begin. But I wrote it at a time when I was estranged from my family. And I was trying basically to forgive them, to forgive myself, to forgive my family.
Let's listen.
When you have forgiven whatever is of earth, of sky, of water, whatever is named, whatever remains nameless, forgive, finally, your own sorry self, clothed in temporary flesh, the breath and blood of you already dying. Dying, forgiven, now you begin.
Pamela Spiro reading from her poem. And Pam, one last question for you. I'm wondering, when you say forgive yourself, how hard it is to look across from you and see the mirror image, the person you might have been, because she's your identical twin.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I'm glad for her. I'm happy for her. She's saved me so often. She's been a wonderful friend.
And you've been a wonderful friend to me, too.
Yeah.
So.
We adore each other.
You know, this illness has, in spite of the suffering it's brought, it's actually, I hate to say it, but it's also enriched our lives in ways that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily have wanted, but one could never have predicted either.
And it brought us closer, I think, than we ever would have been.
So
that's both of us talking.
Yes, it's true.
That's Carolyn Spiro and Pamela Spiro Wagner talking with Robin Young this fall about their memoir, Divided Minds, Twin Sisters and Their Journey Through Schizophrenia. Tomorrow on Here and Now, tracing the footsteps of biblical heroes with Bruce Feiler. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Here and Now. Because the skyrocketing costs of health care are not expected to let up in the new year, some policy analysts are suggesting that the U.S. consider the controversial idea of rationing, which is denying patients some expensive medical procedures. In the new book, Can We Say No? The Challenge of Rationing Health Care, the authors looked at how this works in Britain. Although they found problems, they claim that the U.S. could learn from the U.K.'s experience and should begin discussing what they call sensible rationing, something they say would save money and improve public health in the U.S. Joining us on the line is Henry J. Aaron. He's one of the book's co-authors and a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. Dr. Aaron, why should we consider rationing health care as a way to control rising medical spending?
If we want significantly to slow the growth of overall health care spending, some form of rationing of care, I believe, is the only way that will, in the long haul, make a significant dent in the growth of healthcare spending.
Do we use any form of rationing in healthcare right now?
Well, there's some debate about that. Many people are unable to afford even elementary care because they're not insured and they don't have substantial personal wealth. Many people refer to that as rationing. If it is, then every commodity is rationed because most people can't afford to buy some goods. But for those of us who are well insured, and that includes most of the American population, the prevailing principle is if it helps, do it, and don't weigh the cost that heavily.
Dr. Aaron, when you looked at the U.S. and British systems and compared them in some areas, can you tell me what did you find?
I would be the last person to hold out what they're doing as a model for us. They are have much lower income, and they've spent a much smaller proportion of it on health care. The result has been that they've had to make some really nasty choices, denying care in situations where, in the United States, I think virtually every provider would acknowledge that it should have been provided. But physicians, both in Britain and the United States, frequently will say that we do too much. For example, we do advanced radiological investigations in some cases where the benefits are quite small. I came across one example that personally resonated. If one has a degree of hearing loss in an ear, a British physician rather dismissively said, oh, if you go to an American audiologist, the first thing he will do is recommend that you have an MRI for a rather unusual form of cancer that occasionally, very rarely, causes that. I had some hearing loss, went to see a radiologist, and he said, I think you should have an MRI. And I said, well, do you think I could wait a bit? Oh, yes, of course. If it doesn't get any worse, there's no problem. It would progress very slowly. Come back in 6 months if you have a problem. Well, that was a year ago.
So if the U.S. tends to overdo and the U.K. tends to underdo, it means that you're sort of asking here that we try to find this middle ground. And I'm also wondering how you define this overdoing and underdoing. If we look at, say, mortality rates from something like our treatment for heart disease, certainly our mortality rates are better. So why doesn't that mean that our system is more effective?
The story on mortality from heart disease is a genuine puzzle. Mortality rates have been dropping in the United States really extremely rapidly for more than a generation. Today, they're less than half of what they were back in, say, 1960. That decline is associated in time with a number of very important advances in the treatment of coronary disease. The mystery here is that in Great Britain, there has been almost as large a decline in coronary mortality. It started later, yet the British perform dramatically fewer of the advanced medical interventions. And they also, when treating high blood pressure, have a less stringent standard. So you're driven inevitably to the conclusion, I think, that there are a great many factors influencing coronary mortality. Angioplasty and coronary artery surgery provide really major improvements in the quality of life and in many conditions the duration of life. But there is also, I think, a widespread view that we may do a bit more of both of those than is medically optimal, and that can do little good. It can actually do harm.
How can we avoid some of the pitfalls, and what's the best way to sort of balance things out?
Well, let me start by saying I don't recommend rationing. What I try to do is point out that we face a choice. The choice is between very rapid growth in healthcare spending arising from a combination of technological advance, new fancy stuff that's good to have in most cases, but is costly, and population aging. That's the problem on the one end of the dilemma. The other is if we want not to experience those very large cost increases, then I think we're going to have to find some way to limit the availability of care to those services where the benefits demonstrably outweigh the cost. There will be wrenching choices that arise if we undertake to achieve those savings. We are going to have to fashion some form of payment system that does not provide open-ended reimbursement for everything that physicians do. We're going to have to find some way of limiting the number of places in which very high technology medical interventions can be provided. These are major shifts from current policy. They will raise very divisive, ethically troubling, and politically vexatious choices for the nation. But we will be on the horns of a dilemma. We will face increases in healthcare spending that will claim ever larger portions of any economic growth we enjoy, that force huge increases in taxation to support the continuation of our commitments to the elderly, the disabled, and the poor, or we will have to find a way to ration medical care. It's not a recommendation I'm making. What I'm trying to do is point out a choice that the nation really cannot escape.
Well, Dr. Aaron, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Henry J. Aaron is a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution and co-author of the book, Can We Say No? The Challenge of Rationing Healthcare. Stay with us. There's more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. A dispute between Russia and Ukraine over natural gas is threatening to make it a very cold winter in several European countries. Russia's state-owned natural gas monopoly, Gazprom, halted shipments to Ukraine after the former Soviet republic rejected price increases. Complicating things further is the fact that Gazprom pipes gas to other European countries like France and Germany across Ukraine. And Russia now claims that Kiev is siphoning off millions of dollars worth of gas to replace its depleted supplies. Ukraine denies that. Well, Fred Weir is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joins us from Moscow. Fred, can you sort this out for us?
Well, probably it was inevitable because Russia has always had differential prices for different countries, especially in the former Soviet area, with low prices, special prices for its friends, and much higher prices for those who are not so friendly. Russia uses energy supplies more or less with a carrot and stick political approach in mind.
So this quadrupling of rates to Ukraine, is this sort of a message here that Ukraine is not among Russia's friends and this is not happening with other countries?
It's clearly the somewhat delayed result of Ukraine's Orange Revolution last year, and Ukraine quite demonstratively broke out of the Russian sphere of influence, declared its intentions to join NATO and the European Union, and I think this is Russia's way of playing really the last card it has to try to influence the internal political situation in Ukraine before the parliamentary elections, which are coming up in March.
But why do this now, as Russia's trying to position itself as a nation that can supply energy? It just assumed chairmanship of the Group of Eight of the world's large developing economies and is trying to say, hey, we're going to be a reliable energy supplier. However, we're still going to do this sort of friends-based pricing system and be able to withhold things based on political situations. How do those two things sort of square?
Even a lot of Russian experts who basically support this say the timing is probably pretty bad, and this could end up hurting Russia's image. On the other hand, the price that Russia is demanding from Ukraine is pretty close to the European average. It's not an exorbitant price by world standards. It just is no more subsidy, which Russia had been providing to Ukraine up until now. So there is a market logic to what Russia is doing. It's just that it is being done so abruptly and so clearly in advance of the parliamentary elections in Ukraine that one suspects that this is mainly a political move.
What about other European countries? How are they affected? I heard that deliveries are down somewhat and pressure is down. What's happening there?
There's some confusion about it, and I guess we'll know better in a few days. But Russia claims it is continuing to ship the normal amounts of gas for Western Europe through that pipeline. It's called the Friendship Pipeline from Soviet times that goes through Ukraine to Poland and Hungary and Western Europe in general. Russia today said that Ukraine is stealing gas and that it stole almost a million cubic meters of gas yesterday. So that may be when we sort out who's telling the truth and how much of what, that may be the reason that deliveries to Western Europe are down.
So the fallout from this, although we may not know, as you said, for a few days exactly what might be happening with gas supplies throughout Europe, but the fallout from this is really tremendous as Russia tries to position itself as an energy supplier, yes?
Well, it's very serious geopolitically. I mean, the whole world has got to be watching this. The most dangerous thing is relations between Russia and Ukraine could be reaching a flashpoint because there are many other issues that divide them. One Russian leader, the defense minister, last week brought up the border issue with the Crimean Peninsula, which is mainly populated by Russians, but which is part of Ukraine. And if they start going beyond the gas issue to things like border disputes and so on, we could be looking at very, very hard times between these two countries.
Fred Weir, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's based in Moscow. Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. And now, it used to be that every small theater across America had an organ. And And those who played them improvised music and sound effects while silent movies were running, becoming local, even national celebrities. Well, theater organists went the way of silent films, but some theater organs survived. Back in March, Here and Now's Lynn Menegon sat down with Ohio musician Clark Wilson at a restored theater organ at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. And she asked him, what's the difference between a church organ and a theater organ?
What you really need to remember is the similarities stop past the fact that both instruments have keyboards, pipes, and they're operated by air. That's where the similarities ended. The theater organ was designed, they were called back in the 19-teens and the 20s when they built them, as the nameplate says, unit orchestra. They were put in theaters around the country to take the places of orchestras to accompany silent films, and so you could have anything at your command. They actually were the world's original synthesizer, shall we say. And so you had different families of tone. You had the brass, the trumpets, and the tubas. You did have church organ sounds in them. Some of the early organs, if you hit a button, it set off a lightning display in the theater. Bird whistles, fire sirens, fire gongs, train whistles, boat whistles, you name it.
Does this have any of that?
This has some of that. There are some tuned sleigh bells. And, of course, chimes. Well, and I can show you very quickly around these different pipes that we talked about, the fanfare trumpets, or maybe the tuba. That pipe is 16 feet long, as opposed to these little pipes that are about a half inch long. And a couple of different things like the orchestral oboe sounded like this. And even a funnier little oriental reed called the kanura.
There's so much kooky stuff.
Well, the fun stuff's just beginning.
This is actually connected to a piano in the corner of the room.
Piano. There is a real piano in these organs as part of the percussion department. The marimba harp. Real xylophone.
So that means up.
It's a real instrument.
There's a real
in the chambers. It's a real wood hammer, wood mallet and a bar instrument, just like you'd see in the orchestra. Same thing with the glockenspiel. And I meant to show you, too, the trap, what we call the traps, are up there as well.
Those are, I think I see them. They're like big flaps that you can control?
Exactly. The pipes always speak at the same volume, and I've got pedals down below. And when I open them, they open flaps or what we call swell shades in the wall. And the more of those open up, the more sound it lets out. So it's just like opening a big Venetian blind up there. But we've got, in this trap section, things like the snare drum.
And I take it that's an actual snare drum up there.
It's a real snare drum, real cymbals, real bass drum, real tom-tom, tambourine, castanets, woodblock, triangle.
Hey, who needs an orchestra?
It's exactly it. Here it is, the unit orchestra.
So orchestra players must have hated this machine.
This replaced a lot of orchestras in theaters because in the 1920s, it was expensive to have a 20 or 30 or 40-piece orchestra for 5 shows a day, 7 days a week, just like it would be today. So hence these instruments were born. And really, as much as that, they were developed because it was found that one player at the console of one of these organs could closer follow a silent film for scoring than you could with a large group of musicians who couldn't all watch the screen and, of course, all had to do the same thing. You could change instantly from scene to scene on the theater organ. And then there were big, thick flutes, and they're not necessarily an imitation of anything, but you could imitate things. But if you turned on the typical theater organ tremulant or vibrato, they became a very romantic sound, and they were played in love scenes.
Where are these organs now?
All in all, the organs wound up sitting then, just sitting in the orchestra pits. Some of them went for scrap drives in World War II, selling off vast amounts of metal that are in them and so on. Sometimes the orchestra pits were cemented over in wartime so they could add three or four more rows of seats. The organ consoles were buried under concrete. They were thrown out in the back alley. People bought organs like this for $100. Into the 70s, they went into pizza restaurants, pizza parlors, and that the organist sat up there and played requests from the patrons all night long, and they were very, very popular. Today, we as concert artists kind of grimace when somebody says, oh, the theater organ in a roller rink, because you think, oh, good heavens. And that's what so many people still think of. You know, they don't think of this as much of an art. Well, you just turn on the drums and away you go, thrump, boom. But that's not at all. These organs are capable of playing anything. People have said for years, well, it's not really a legitimate instrument because there's no music ever been written for the theater organ. There doesn't need to be any music written for the theater organ. Everything is playable on the theater organ. It's I think, the supreme making of music. Because most instruments, if you play the trumpet, you can only play one note at a time, unless there are people out there I don't know about. And you need your whole orchestra to make the finished piece of music. And with these theater organs, I'm a symphony conductor every time I sit down at one of these organs. The orchestra is mine. I mean, you could do that on the piano, of course. You can play a finished composition. But this, and it's an all-encompassing sound. It was the original stereo because these organs were installed in lofts on both sides of the theaters and came at you from both directions, sometimes in the rear of the balcony as well. So it's the original stereo. It's the original surround sound. Even today, when I play one of these instruments for intermissions in the Ohio Theater in Columbus, a classic movie series that we do, we'll pick it up at intermission. And the movie's playing out, and you've got this surround sound, you've got Dolby stereo, you've got everything known to man. And when that fades out and the organ comes in, it's 10 times what you've just heard. It plays the building, is what happens. It moves the air in the room, it shakes your bones. It does the whole thing.
It rattles the floor. When I was standing here listening to you play, the floor vibrates.
It's something that you feel as well. And you see, that's impossible with electronic music today. These organs produce. So to me, this is the grandest instrument that's ever been conceived by the mind of man. The organ, in general, has always been called the king of instruments. And the theater organ is the monarch of the whole family.
Our interview with theater organist Clark Wilson was produced by Here and Now's Lynn Menegon. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the